Wondery Plus subscribers can binge new seasons of American Scandal early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. A listener note, this episode contains references to adult content and language and contains material that some might find offensive. It's June 17th, 1964, in New York City. Inside the Manhattan Criminal Courts building, a crowd has gathered. They're hovering near the door to courtroom 535, where a sign reads, "Standing room only." The crowd murmurs in anticipation. Reporters, spectators, prospective witnesses, they're all here for day two of the Lenny Bruce obscenity trial. Inside the courtroom, the famous comedian sits at the defense table. He's staring grimly at the American flag near the witness stand. Hypocrites, Bruce thinks to himself. The flag has no place in this courtroom, a courtroom where prosecutors are completely ignoring the First Amendment. Just then, across the room, Assistant District Attorney Richard Q pushes back his chair and stands. Q gives off a commanding presence with his thick black hair and three-piece suit. Bruce anxiously picks at his fingernails. His nerves are shot. Then he turns to the elegant graying man sitting beside him, his defense attorney, Ephraim London.
Gotta tell you, Lundo, that guy makes me jittery, especially after what happened to the cop you put on the stand.
Patrolman O'Neill?
Yeah, O'Neill. Why weren't you more aggressive with the cross-examination? It was like watching a nanny changing her first diaper. I need you to tear these guys apart. If they find me guilty of obscenity, it's all over for me, man.
Lenny, I thought we were clear on this. I intend to present our case my way. I know what I'm doing. And if you want to win, follow my lead. And quiet, please. We're about to resume.
Bruce starts to argue again, but London shushes him. Q glances over at the defense table with a look of annoyance. Then he speaks to the court.
The prosecution will now call Inspector Herbert Rue to the stand.
Bruce glares at the inspector. He notes Rue's glasses and thin mustache. He certainly remembers him from that night at Café Al Gogo. Bruce had sensed there was something off about a guy sitting alone at a table taking notes at a comedy show. And soon enough, the cops showed up. They hauled Bruce straight to the precinct headquarters. They also arrested the club's owners, Howard and Ella Solomon. Inspector Rue is sworn in, and Q begins his direct examination.
Inspector Rue, were you present at the Café Al Gogo the night of March 31st?
Yes, sir, I was.
Did you take detailed notes of the defendant's performance that evening?
Yes. In fact, I have those notes right here.
Could you please read the first section you identified as obscene?
Rue sits up straight, clears his throat, and begins to read. He even begins a slight impersonation of Lenny Bruce.
Well, now, the British, they talk nice. Such beautiful sounds. They can even make the word shit sound nice. Sounds elegant the way they say it.
Bruce's jaw drops. He turns to London and grabs his arm.
What's he doing? Is that supposed to be me?
Lenny, please. I'll handle it.
Rue continues his reenactment, which for Bruce feels increasingly bizarre.
Eating is very important. I say eating's really an act of oral copulation. Of course, most schmucks wouldn't understand. You know, the word schmuck is a very interesting word. In Yiddish, it literally means a man's penis.
Bruce has had enough.
Oh, for God's sake, Lundo. I said the schmuck thing like 15 minutes after the food thing. I don't jam it together like that. And the delivery's all wrong. Where's his timing?
London finally speaks up.
Objection. The witness is only recounting what he personally considers obscene. His testimony fails to capture the artistic and philosophical nuance of my client's performance.
Bruce nods his head vigorously. He couldn't have said it better himself. He looks hopefully at the three judges who will decide his fate, and one shakes his head. The judge overrules the objection. Bruce sinks down into a seat, and then he says to no one in particular,
"Man, this guy is bombing. I'm going to jail for it."
There's been a dull ache in Bruce's chest, and suddenly that ache flares to a sharp pain. As Rue continues his testimony, Lenny Bruce winces in agonizing pain. He's felt this pain before. He needs medical attention, and he needs it now.
American Scandal is sponsored by Audible. I get the thrill of, say, skydiving.
But it's a lot of work and expense for something that lasts only minutes and comes with some safety concerns. Instead, I get my thrills in a lower dose, stretched out over hours with a good mystery. Like in the Penguin modern classic Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Susskind. And as an Audible member, I can choose one title every month to keep forever from the entire catalog of classics, bestsellers, new releases, and Audible originals ready to listen whenever, wherever on the Audible app. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. That's audible.com/AS or text AS to 500-500. American Scandal is sponsored by True Green. This is a true story. Right now, fertilizer is spilled all over my garage, and the fertilizer spreader has lost a wheel. While I'm usually pretty DIY, some things I leave to professionals. True Green is the easiest and most affordable way to a beautiful lawn. You water and mow, they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. You can trust True Green to give you the best lawn because they are the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. They offer a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. So you do you and let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people, guaranteed. From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is American Scandal. In the summer of 1964, Lenny Bruce faced a high-stakes trial in New York City. The celebrated comedian was charged with a crime of performing obscene material at a local nightclub. A guilty conviction could land him behind bars. The trial, though, carried a larger significance for American culture. Bruce admitted that he was vulgar, but he believed that his work revealed difficult truths about modern life. And so the trial was a test about the limits of free speech. Yet Lenny Bruce's obscenity trial placed a huge toll on Bruce himself. And as the stress of his situation mounted, Bruce entered a downward spiral of self-destruction and drug use. Nevertheless, he was determined to prove his innocence, and he wanted people to see him as he believed he truly was, a sensitive and observant artist ahead of his time. This is episode 2, I'm Not a Comedian. It's June 22, 1964, in New York City. At the Flower and Fifth Avenue Hospital, Ephraim London slowly pushes open the door to a private room. Harsh fluorescent light beams down from above. The smell of Lysol is in the air. As London enters, he sees Lenny Bruce sitting upright in his bed. His client looks pale. Bruce is hooked up to an IV, but he's also chuckling to himself and jotting down something in a notebook. London notices something else. The faint pink marks along the comedian's bare arms. It's the first time he's ever seen heroin tracks up close. London is disturbed by the sight, and even feels a little lightheaded himself, but he's also irritated because despite Bruce's talent, he's putting his life at risk with dangerous, disgusting drugs. Bruce closes his notebook, turns to London and smiles.
Londo, you escaped the courthouse.
How are you, Lenny?
Oh, perfectly fine, Londo. Just a wee bit of pleurisy, no big deal. Gives me time to work out some new material. What brings you to my posh little penthouse? You bring me flowers?
London smiles weakly and shakes his head. No flowers. But I did bring you some promising news. Bruce raises an eyebrow. London pulls up a chair to Bruce's bedside and leans forward. Lenny, the U.S. Supreme Court has just ruled in another obscenity trial. It involved a French film called The Lovers. The court decided that the film has socially redeeming value, and they say it should not be considered obscene, and no one should get arrested for exhibiting it in the United States. The Lovers, huh? Sounds like my kind of movie. London shakes his head impatiently. Lenny, the point is, the court's ruling helps our case in a very large way. If we can establish that your act has socially redeeming value, it shouldn't be considered obscene either. Bruce's face brightens. My act's got loads of socially redeeming value. You heard my bit about pot. One day it's going to be legal, so all those congressmen can protect themselves. Lenny, I know. I heard. I got one about church people. You know, I respect their beliefs, but I don't respect that they say one thing and they do another. You've told me that one too. So what then? We present this new Supreme Court case to the judges and the trial's over? Well, no, not exactly. But it should influence the judges to view our case more favorably. Well, that's amazing, Lundo. When do we have to be back in court? 8 days. 8 days? Perfect. Plenty of time to book a gig, maybe even two. Lenny, you're in no shape to perform. I don't have a choice. After this little hospital stay, I'm practically broke. And you don't come cheap yourself either, unless you're willing to work pro bono. No, I can't do that, Lenny. Then I guess I gotta go out and make some more bread. It's late June, 1964. Inside the Cork and Bib Jazz Club in Long Island, the air is heavy with cigarette smoke. Lenny Bruce inhales deeply and grins. He's booked 4 shows here over the weekend, and he'll earn $1,100, enough to hold off his creditors for a while. Bruce rubs his hands together. The Cork and Bib is his kind of establishment. A mixed crowd of jazz fans snap their fingers, and a saxophone player on stage launches into a dizzying solo. Bruce bops his head to the music as he heads towards the bar. He's eyeing a pretty cocktail waitress when a police officer approaches. The officer introduces himself. His name is Norman Levy, and he's a local squad chief. Levy says he doesn't want any trouble. Bruce can perform tonight as long as he keeps his act within the bounds of the law. Bruce gives Levy a sarcastic salute. Then he downs his whiskey and orders another. As Bruce waits for the drink, Levy asks if he can record Bruce's act. Bruce shrugs, sure, why not, and asks the officer if he's heard about the new Supreme Court case, the one about the film The Lovers. Levy shakes his head. It's nothing really, Bruce says nonchalantly. It just means everything I'm going to say tonight is totally legal. The jazz band ends its set, and Bruce makes his way to the stage. He picks up the mic and launches in. He's happy to discover that he's not rusty at all. He digs in and challenges the hypocrisies in middle-class life, politicians, America's cultural taboos. His biting commentary pours out in what feels like an uncontrollable torrent. Times like this, he feels like he has more in common with jazz musicians than comedians. What jazz players do with musical notes, he does with words. He explores, improvises, he invents something new on the spot, and the crowd can't seem to get enough. 40 minutes later, Bruce walks off stage to wild applause. Officer Levy is waiting in the wings. The club's owner stands next to him, wearing a pained expression. Levy points a meaty finger at Bruce and says that tonight's material was borderline obscene. If he performs it here again, he'll be arrested. Bruce rolls his eyes as Levy walks away. He turns to the club owner and tells him not to worry. The cops can't really do anything. He's got the Supreme Court on his side. The club owner sighs, though, and looks at the floor. He's really sorry, but he can't let Bruce go on again. Bruce is stunned. He had the crowd laughing through the entire show tonight, but the owner says the performance isn't the problem. It's the liquor license. If the cops arrest Bruce, the club could very well lose its license, and the owner could even wind up in court like the Solomons. Bruce feels a rising sense of panic. He is out of money, and there's no one else in New York who will book him. Bruce pleads, "I need your help," but the club owner shakes his head sadly. He'll pay for tonight's show, but that's all he can do. Bruce looks away. He felt euphoric to be on stage, but once again he feels worn out, beaten down. He realizes there's just one solution. He has to win his trial. That's the only way he'll be able to put to rest the fears of America's club owners. And if he loses in New York, well, then his career is truly over. It's June 30th, 1964. Efren London checks his watch and continues to climb the steps of the Manhattan Criminal Courts building. Lenny Bruce lags a few steps behind, wearing a tattered black jacket and sunglasses. London frowns. His client looks like he hasn't showered in weeks. London understands why Bruce is depressed. It must have been hard to have his shows canceled so abruptly. But then again, London thinks, maybe it's just the drugs. It's really none of his business, though. Only one thing matters: proving to the court that Bruce's act has socially redeeming value. Before he does that, though, he wants to try something else. He wants to take one more stab at getting the charges dismissed altogether. London pushes open the doors to the courtroom. He and Bruce sit down next to Howard and Ella Solomon. They're joined by the defense's two co-counsels, Alan Schwartz
and Martin Garbus. Garbus is a 30-year-old graduate of NYU Law and has proven especially useful during the trial. Unlike London, he's a fan of Bruce's comedy. When London struggles to follow Bruce's twisted rhetoric, Garbus is always ready to explain. Soon, three justices take their seats on the bench. London stands, and here he makes a motion to dismiss the charges against Bruce and end the trial today. Judge John Murtaugh sighs. He points out that London has asked twice for this before and was denied. The justice wants to know what's changed. London says that he'd like the justices to consider this case from a different angle. He wants them to think of the so-called obscene words that Bruce is alleged to have used. Why exactly, he asks, are some words acceptable to use in society while others are not? London asks that everyone in the courtroom be honest with themselves, and he explains the reason why certain words are taboo is because they tend to be used by working-class people, people in the lower economic rungs of society. But, London says, the country's founders intended the First Amendment to protect the rights of everyone in America, and that includes those at the bottom. The justices have a unique opportunity here to affirm that principle once and for all. London waits quietly as the judges confirm. After several minutes, Judge Murtaugh turns back towards London, and the motion to dismiss is denied. Frustrated, London sits. Bruce is stone-faced. London pulls some notes from his briefcase and begins reading. At this point, there's little else to do but get ready for the rest of the afternoon. He's certainly disappointed, but London's hardly ready to give up. In fact, he still believes he can pull off a victory, and today he plans to call a number of successful writers and critics to the stand. All of them support Bruce. London figures these experts will help sway the judges because they'll attest to the importance of Bruce's art, and the judges will finally understand that the comic is not obscene, but rather that his work has significance to American society. A few hours later, Lenny Bruce sits up in his seat at the defense table. Ephraim London has just called Richard Gilman to the stand. Gilman is a literary critic with Newsweek and wears a stylish suit that suggests that he's both smart and hip. Bruce likes him, and Gilman supports Bruce. He tells the court that Bruce's intention is artistic. Bruce removes the stigma from certain words, and in doing so, reveals important truths. Bruce is amazed. This endorsement of his art is far more than he could have hoped for. And soon, Bruce's old friend Nat Hentoff takes the stand. Hentoff, the writer for The Village Voice, tells the court that Bruce is a moral comedian, more so than any of his contemporaries. Hentoff is followed by Alan Morrison, the city editor of Ebony magazine. Morrison says that Bruce's social satire is superb, and it demonstrates a concern for social issues, including racial equality, bigotry, and religious intolerance. More experts continue to testify on Bruce's behalf. They compare him to writers like James Baldwin and Tennessee Williams, and one of the experts, a Christian minister, says that Lenny Bruce verges on genius. After each witness steps down, Bruce looks them in the eyes and mouths the words, "Thank you." He feels a sense of gratitude that's almost overwhelming. He bows his head, does nothing to keep the tears from falling. Martin Garbus pats his shoulder, and Bruce smiles. He feels a renewed commitment to this battle. He'll show this court and the world that Lenny Bruce is more than just a troublemaker with a foul mouth. He's an artist.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's July 1964 in San Francisco. Lenny Bruce walks into his room at the Swiss American Hotel and kicks aside a pile of unwashed clothes. The room is small, but to Bruce, it's far less claustrophobic than courtroom 535. Bruce had rejoiced when Justice Murtaugh announced the court would take a 3-week recess for summer vacation. And since arriving in San Francisco, he spent almost every night on stage at a club called the Off-Broadway. His shows have gone well and the money is finally trickling back in. Best of all, no cops hassling him. They've mostly left him alone ever since his San Francisco obscenity trial was dismissed on a technicality. In his hotel room, Bruce sits down at a rickety writing desk. He begins flipping through his mail. He tosses aside a couple of envelopes that look suspiciously like bills. The next envelope, though, is addressed to Mr. Lenny Bruce with a return address in New York. Bruce feels a sudden wild hope. Maybe it's a note from the DA's office informing him that the trial recess has been extended. Or maybe, he thinks, there's been another technicality. Maybe the trial's been dismissed. His pulse quickens as he tears open the envelope. He unfolds the letter and begins to read. "Dear Lenny, I will keep this short. You must return to New York." With those words, Bruce's heart sinks. He recognizes the handwriting now. It belongs to his attorney, Ephraim London. London explains that the recess is ending and he must be present when court resumes next week. If not, he'll forfeit bail and face other penalties, and he will almost certainly lose his case. Bruce drops the letter and slams the desk with his fist. This is not what he wants. Just last week, he wrote London a very clear letter. He explained that he had to stay in San Francisco to make money. It's the only major city in America where he can safely perform. In Bruce's opinion, there's no reason why he needs to sit in the actual courtroom while London defends him. Bruce looks around the cluttered room. He's looking for his lighter, spoon, and syringe. He needs to take the edge off. Bruce decides he'll go back to New York as ordered. But he's done playing by his lawyer's rules. All these attorneys and justices, they claim to be legal experts, but he's the one on trial. So he makes a resolution. Tomorrow, he'll visit the public library and check out every law book he can find. Because the next time he faces a judge, he wants to be prepared. It's July 28, 1964 in New York. Inside courtroom 535, Richard Q makes his final impassioned arguments to the court. But Lenny Bruce is focused on something else. These last few days, he's been studying his legal case. He's taken copious notes on every witness for the prosecution and in wild scribbles refuted their arguments. He's drawn numerous parallels between his case and cases from the past. Bruce studies his papers. He believes that here in his hand is a blueprint for his exoneration. He snorts to himself. He didn't need Ephraim London. He could have conducted his defense all by himself. He can see it right here. He has the smarts and the talent, and now he's about to prove it. Bruce puts his notepad down. He caps his pen as Richard Q reaches his conclusion.
"At this point, Your Honor, the people rest."
Justice Murtaugh nods. He opens his mouth to speak, and right then, Lenny Bruce pushes his chair and stands. He ignores the look of shock on Ephraim London's face.
"Your Honor, I would like to ask the court to allow me to speak. There's evidence that's been withheld from the court."
Judge Murtaugh shoots him a withering scowl.
"The court strongly advises you to be guided by the wisdom of your attorney. You are fortunate in having most distinguished and able counsel."
"Yes, I do have counsel, but I have trouble communicating with them. This evidence is very important.
Excuse me, Mr. Bruce. We'll take a short recess to allow you to consult with your counsel."
Bruce sits down. He notes the appalled expression on the faces of Garbus, Schwartz, and the Solomons. He can tell they're going to beg him not to go through with this. But it's London who speaks up first.
"What the hell are you doing?"
"Winning the case.
Lenny, we may have already won it. You want to jeopardize that on the very last day of the trial? You're making a huge mistake."
"I know what to say, Lundo. I know all the First Amendment precedents. I can do a bit of my act here so the judges get it. It'll convince them to let us off the hook, you know?"
Lenny, I cannot allow you to do that. If you take the stand, it's like handing Q a winning lottery ticket.
London then points at the Solomons.
And then think about Howard and Ella. You're putting them at even greater risk.
No, I'm not, Londo.
I'm saving them. The fact that you can't see that, it's why that we're still in this mess. Now step aside, man. I'm going up.
Fine. You want to ruin your life and theirs? I can't stop you. But I don't have to watch you do it either.
London stands and begins shoving documents into his briefcase.
What are you doing?
I'm quitting. If you testify today, I will walk straight out of this courtroom. You'll never see me again.
Bruce's eyes dart quickly to Howard and Ella. They look helpless, terrified. Bruce looks away and gathers his thoughts. His shoulders slump, and he turns back to London.
Jesus, Ephraim, take it easy.
London stops packing his briefcase. Bruce lowers his head slightly.
Okay, fine.
We'll try it your way. Breathing heavily, London sits down and smooths his tie. He turns to the judges, his face still red.
Your Honor, Mr. Bruce has agreed to be guided by my advice. The defense rests.
Murtaugh raises his gavel.
Court is adjourned.
After 43 grueling days, the trial is over. The justices will announce their verdict on November 4th. Bruce stands. He brushes past London without saying another word, and he heads for the exit. It's September 2nd, 1964. Lenny Bruce stumbles through a darkened living room. It's just after 2 a.m., and Bruce is in his two-story home in Hollywood, California. In one hand, he holds a baggie of light brown powder. His other hand is wrapped around a bottle of Jack Daniels. Bruce pauses. He stares out the floor-to-ceiling windows, watching the twinkling lights of West Hollywood, and laughs bitterly. Ephraim London thinks he's dumb, but a dumb guy could never afford a house like this. And speaking of London, it's time for Bruce to deal with him once and for all. Bruce arrives at his wood-paneled office and flips on the light. He sits down at his desk and gazes at a framed photo. It's his ex-wife, Honey, looking like she's smiling back at him. Bruce remembers taking that picture. It was a perfect day in Santa Monica, 8 years ago. Suddenly, Bruce is furious. He yanks open a drawer and grabs a sheet of paper and pen. He throws back a slug of whiskey and then starts writing. In a letter to Ephraim London, he launches angry accusations at the lawyer. He says that London ruined the trial, and Bruce reminds London that he's detailed hundreds of errors in the police transcripts from the Café Au Gogo. Bruce can't understand why his lawyer wouldn't submit these documents, why he wants to wait and use them on a possible appeal. Bruce feels himself gaining steam, his hand flying across the page. What is the matter with you, Ephraim? He writes. Bruce pauses and then comes to a decision. He orders London to submit the documents to get them into the official record. And if London won't do so, Bruce says, well, then he's not paying the attorney's fees. With that, Bruce leans back, suddenly spent. He intends to mail the letter the second the post office opens, which is just a few hours away. To get to sleep, he grabs the bag of brown powder and a syringe. It's November 4th, 1964. Bruce is back in New York City for the first time in months, dressed in his courtroom uniform, skin-tight black pants with a black leather jacket. Bruce enters the courthouse. Feels good to enter by himself without any lawyers at his side, the way it should have been all along. He sent his letter to Ephraim London 2 months ago. London responded by suing him for breach of contract. Bruce isn't worried about the suit. If London wants any money out of him, he'll have to pry it out of Bruce's cold, dead hands. Bruce feels a rising excitement as he walks down the long marble hall. It's the kind of excitement he gets just before going on stage, which is appropriate. Today, he fully intends to turn the courtroom into a one-man show, a performance that will prove his innocence once and for all. Bruce strides into courtroom 535 and smiles at the judges and the Solomons. None of them smile back. Instead, Murtaugh tells Bruce he's 15 minutes late and that his tardiness is not appreciated. He says that the judges have arrived at their decision, and they'll now announce their verdict. Murtaugh seems to notice that Bruce is alone and asks if he's represented by counsel. Bruce says he'll be representing himself today. He then asks if he can address the court. Murtaugh sighs and gestures for him to proceed. Please, Your Honor, Bruce begins. I want to show you today that my performance is not obscene. I will prove that every word I've ever said is in the dictionary. Murtaugh looks bewildered. He tells Bruce that the court already has all the arguments. But the court hasn't heard my show, Bruce cries. Murtaugh raises his voice.
in a tone of extreme exasperation. He reminds Bruce that the case is closed, the verdict is ready. Bruce suddenly realizes that Murtaugh is really, truly not going to let him reopen this trial. He can't believe it. He prepared for this moment, rehearsed every day, and all for nothing. The court won't let him plead his case in his own words. Bruce feels panic creep down his spine. He takes a few desperate steps toward the bench. The bailiff warns him to stay where he is. Bruce looks around the room wildly, but there's no one to help him. He begs the judge not to end his career in show business. But Murtaugh bangs his gavel and shouts over him. The court finds Lenny Bruce and Howard L. Solomon guilty. Ella Solomon is not guilty. The defendants will be sentenced the next month. Gavel comes down one last time. The judges rise to leave. Bruce cannot believe what he just heard. It's over, and he's lost. He grips his curly hair in both hands, fighting a wave of nausea. Murmuring, the court audience begins to file out. Bruce looks at them, but they turn away. They seem embarrassed. Bruce pushes past them, his eyes blurry with tears. The bailiff tells him he must remain for fingerprinting. Bruce takes one look at the bailiff's ink pad, turns away, and walks out.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's December 21st, 1964. The New York courtroom that's been home to the People v. Bruce is as crowded as ever. Martin Garbus is packed into the back with the rest of the onlookers. He can hear the wind as it howls outside the building. He feels like he's at a funeral of a good friend. In many ways, he is. Garbus is a true fan of Lenny Bruce's comedy. He was also Bruce's legal co-counsel until Bruce fired him along with Ephraim London. London will have nothing to do with Bruce now, won't even speak his name. Garbus, though, doesn't take his firing personally. Bruce is just a temperamental artist, and he really did have a good case. Garbus still can't believe the judges ruled against him. The day the verdict was announced was a dark day for the Constitution, he thinks. But today feels darker. It's the day Bruce will be sentenced. Garbus is here in a show of moral support, though the comedian hasn't noticed him yet. Because Bruce is too busy making one last desperate plea for acquittal. It's sad for Garbus to see Bruce this way. Overweight, unshaven, eyes puffy and bloodshot, begging the judges to reconsider. Bruce couldn't even bother to put on his stylish all-black outfit. Instead, he wears a striped T-shirt under a filthy trench coat. He looks to Garbus like a man at the end of his rope. Garbus wishes there was some way he could help, but he knows that Bruce would never accept it. The crowd goes quiet as the court is called to order. In a clear voice, Judge Murtaugh announces Bruce's sentence, 4 months in prison. Howard Solomon has the option of paying a $500 fine or doing 30 days alongside Bruce at Rikers Island. Solomon hugs his wife and smiles. They weep openly with relief. The Solomons got off quite easy in the end, and Garbus is happy for them. Bruce, on the other hand, has no one to hug. He looks utterly defeated. Garbus turns to the exit. Bruce will be okay, he thinks, and the sentence could have been much, much worse. Garbus is about to reach the door when he hears Bruce calling his name. He turns, looks back, then greets the comedian warmly. Bruce smiles at him. His eyes are shiny, his voice hoarse. He tells Garbus that he's flat broke. He didn't even bring enough for cab fare back to his friend's place. Could Garbus spare a couple of bucks? Garbus is choked up. He clears his throat. I drove, Lenny, he says quietly. Let me give you a ride. It's March 1965 in San Francisco. Bruce is back in his favorite room at the Swiss American Hotel. He's done a few shows recently and made a couple thousand dollars. After each performance, he invites anyone who will join him back to his hotel room. They smoke, they drink, they use a lot of drugs, inhaled through their noses and shot into their arms. Tonight, the room is dense with clouds of marijuana and cigarette smoke. A Charlie Parker record plays at full volume. Bruce swings his head wildly to the music. His friend Eric Miller, a local nightclub musician, sits in an armchair looking around. He turns to Bruce. Hey, man, what's all that on your bed? Bruce gazes across the teetering stacks of thick, hardcover books.
My legal library. All those books are for the case.
Oh, right. How's the case going, man?
Not bad, not bad. New York said I was guilty and gave me 4 months, but I haven't served a single day. It's all under appeal. Meanwhile, I'm just researching, man, just researching.
Researching? Researching what?
Everything. The entire history of the legal system. Every single case ever. And you know what? In the end, I'm going to win.
Miller nods, but skeptically.
Right on, Lenny. Right on.
Bruce fishes in his pocket and pulls out a tightly rolled joint. He flicks his lighter, then takes a hit.
Hey, you want something of this? I added a little something special. DMT. Gotta keep it interesting, you know? Tryptamine? Nah, man. I don't screw around with that. Thanks, so. Suit yourself.
Bruce takes another hit, then crosses over to the window.
You know, I gotta tell you, the last couple of years have not been easy, but it's starting to turn around. There's gonna be a surprise ending to all of this. Mark my words. Hey, Lenny, don't lean against the glass like that.
Hold on, let me finish. There's going to be a big party, and all the judges and all the DAs are going to give me a big, shiny medal for revolutionizing the judicial system. I'm telling you, they're going to call me Legal Lenny. Legal Lenny. Bruce is suddenly on the sidewalk, covered in blood. Shards of glass are lodged in his face. Bruce finally regains his breath.
Holy wow. That's a trip.
Miller is right beside him.
Don't talk. We called an ambulance.
A police officer approaches.
Oh, thank God. Officer, he had an accident. Fell out of the window. Please, please help him.
Sir, are you all right, sir? Don't move. Don't move. Stay there. We're here to help.
But Bruce pushes away pieces of glass and staggers to his feet.
You want to help me? Like you helped me back in 61? Like you helped me in New York and you helped me in Chicago? You mother...
Bruce starts swinging wildly as other officers arrive and swarm at him from every side. The last thing Bruce remembers is being wrestled to the ground. Then his world goes black. It's mid-February 1966 in Hollywood, California. Lenny Bruce hovers on stage at the neon-lit Music Box Theater. His hair is tangled and his stomach hangs out from beneath an untucked shirt. Bruce realizes that he's in the middle of a joke, but he can't remember the punchline. He stifles a giggle. The heroin has certainly kicked in. Someone coughs. Bruce leans toward the microphone and there's a loud screech of feedback. "Say something funny," someone yells. Someone else tells the heckler to shut up. Bruce waves his arm for everyone just to calm down. Informs the crowd that he's run out of stories to tell. He told them about his arrests, his trials, what he's learned about the legal system. That's all there is to know about him. He shrugs as he peers down at the disappointed faces in the audience. "I guess I wasn't all that funny tonight," he says, slurring. "But what can I tell you? I'm not a comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce." Several months later, Bruce sits on the couch in his Hollywood home next to his girlfriend, the red-haired comedian Lotus Weinstock. He stares at the TV screen, his expression blank. Bewitched is on. Whenever the laugh track kicks in, Bruce laughs too. Then he goes quiet. It's 8:15 p.m. and he's sleepy. Weinstock tells Bruce she's been thinking. Maybe they should go to the beach tomorrow. In a flat voice, Bruce says he'd prefer not to. Weinstock protests and says they never go out anymore. He never goes out anymore. It's been at least a week since he left the house. Doesn't he want just a little sun? It'd be good for him. Bruce sighs and picks up the remote. He turns down the volume on Bewitched, then faces Weinstock. He says he has something to tell her. And when he says it, he doesn't want her to react. He just needs to hear himself say it out loud. Weinstock leans forward, a worried expression on her face. I'm going to die this year, Bruce says. Weinstock stares at Bruce, her mouth agape. She waits for him to say more, but he retreats into his own thoughts. He tries to imagine a future for himself, but he can't. He's lost his wife. He's lost his career. He's almost out of money, maybe for good. There aren't many places left where he can still perform. The only thing he enjoys these days is sitting alone at home with a needle in his arm and a finger on the plunger. But that's turning out to be no good either. When he's high, all he does is dwell on happier times that are long gone. He sees Weinstock wipe something from the corner of her eye. She forces a cheerful smile. She says they should make a deal. If she goes out to the store right now and buys him those raisin cookies he likes, will he at least wait a year to die? Bruce sighs, reaches out and touches her face. He nods sure, and then says, you get me those raisin cookies and I'll wait a year. She pops up off the couch, slips on her shoes and heads for the door. Bruce smiles after her, then turns back to the TV. He hopes he'll be able to keep his end of the bargain, but he can't make any promises. On August 3rd, 1966, just 2 months later, Lenny Bruce died in his Hollywood home. The cause of death was an overdose of morphine. He was 40 years old. At the time of his death, he had won his cases in Los Angeles and Chicago, but was still appealing his verdict in New York. Lenny Bruce's death raised important questions among the public. Americans asked whether the criminal justice system had overstepped and pushed the comedian to an early grave. This, in turn, forced a broader conversation about the value of free speech and the role of artists in American life. And soon, the criminal justice system began to shift. Prosecutors focused less on comedians and turned their attention to other offenders. Lenny Bruce suffered as he fought for the freedom of speech and performance, but he paved the way for future comedians who could perform incisive and even vulgar material without the fear of arrest. Bruce's trials and his eventual death helped lay the foundation for American culture today. In 2003, New York Governor George Pataki issued a posthumous pardon to Lenny Bruce. It was the first such pardon in state history. Pataki called it a declaration of New York's commitment to upholding the First Amendment. Next on American Scandal, I speak with Brett Gary, professor at NYU. Gary studies media, American culture, and politics, and focuses on the public battles over censorship. He joins us to discuss the profound impact of Lenny Bruce's obscenity trials. From Wondery, this is American Scandal. Just a quick note about our reenactments. We can't always know exactly what was said, but everything in our show is based on historical research. American Scandal is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Sound designed by Derek Behrens. This episode is written by Hannibal Diaz. Edited by Christina Malzberger. Produced by Gabe Ribbon. Executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Laura Beckman, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.